From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we'll break down yesterday's race for state Supreme Court justice.
Then Governor Evers' budget proposal includes increased funds for juvenile prisons. Some community advocates are questioning the move.
People are saying, why are we spending all of this money on these buildings when we should be investing in XYZ program? And what those programs are, people have different ideas for things that they would like to see in place.
The Lambarena is an exuberant fusion of classical ballet and African dance that makes its Milwaukee debut tonight.
You always have your detractors, your purists, that you can't do that, either musically or dance-wise. You should not be mixing cultures. And my thing is, dance is universal. Dance unites people. That's how you learn each other's culture, through dance. Why not?
And Eau Claire novelist Nick Butler's new novel is on the nature of faith and life in small town Wisconsin. Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Wisconsin voters went to the polls yesterday to elect a new justice to serve a 10-year term on the state Supreme Court.
And like so many races in our state's recent political history, this one appears to be too close to call and headed for a likely recount, with Brian Hagedorn holding a narrow lead at this point. Political analyst Mordecai Lee joins us on the line. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much, Mitch.
So on first blush, is it fair to say this is the latest evidence of a rural-urban voter divide in this state?
You know, when you look at a map, I think that's a fair conclusion. But if I were to try to give a theme to the results, I'd say that if last year was the blue wave, and if people were wondering if the blue wave is still existing this year, I'd say the blue wave is still existing, but a red wave came out of nowhere and really sort of checkmated the blue wave. And so if it's true that conservative voters are re-energized, then that really changes the political picture.
About 1.2 million people voted in this election, which is low for the number of registered voters. But, you know, this was an off-year spring election. How much can you read into results from an election that is, you know, both far away from other major races and also has, you know, relatively low voter turnout?
Mitch, I think you're really focusing on the right detail, because this was an astonishing turnout when you look at sort of previous record. In the previous Supreme Court races, when there was about 700,000, 800,000 people running, the de facto Republican always won. Last year, when there was a million people voting, the de facto Democrat won. So here we are with 1.2 million. The only race that's similar to that, you'd have to go back to 2011, the Kloppenburg-Prosser race, which was sort of a referendum on Act 10. That was 1.5 million people, and that was won in a squeaker by the de facto Republican. So I think there's sort of a sweet spot for Republicans and Democrats. Low turnout and very high turnout is good for the right, and medium turnout, about 1 million votes, is good for the left.
It is technically a nonpartisan race. I don't know that we saw too many leading politicians sticking their necks out in this. How does the nature of campaigning in a race like this play into how people vote?
Well, I think politics has become television advertising. Of course, they have get-out-the-vote efforts. Of course, they have volunteers making phone calls. But it's television that reaches people, especially when you're going to voters who usually don't vote in this kind of an election. So I'd say the last 200,000 voters were really the ones who were touched by television. And if I had to do a quick postmortem, I think those attack ads in the last week or two by the right, the candidate on the right, were really powerful, and that the candidate on the left probably made a decision not to pop back with an equally strong, even if misleading, kind of advertising. You know, Bill Clinton used to have a principle that if somebody pops you, you have to pop them back. And that came true when John Kerry was running against President George W. Bush. Kerry wanted to run a positive race. Bush and his allies ran a very negative race, like Swiss voting. And I thought the lesson was learned. You have to respond to an attack with an equal attack.
So I feel like we were talking about potential recounts just a few months ago, but as of this conversation we're having right now, about 5,500 votes separate the two candidates. It does not trigger an automatic recount, but it is close enough that the Neubauer campaign could call for one if they pay for it. How would a campaign go about making that decision?
Well, I think it's relatively easy. If you have to pay for it, can you raise the money? You know, it's so interesting that it used to be at a much different threshold for an automatic recount. I think it was at 0.5%. And that was what happened in the Klappenberg-Prosser race. Klappenberg did not have to pay for it. And then, if I recall correctly, the Republican legislature lowered that to 25% because they didn't like the recount that happened after the presidential race that was paid for by the Green Party. So this is now turning out sort of in their favor as a way of putting a burden on the losing candidate to have to pay for it. I'm guessing that we're not going to see much change between the unofficial results and what's called the canvas. That's the official report. And I'm also guessing we're not going to see much change when it comes to a recount. But nonetheless, it would be obvious that Neubauer would want to have a recount, if only so that her supporters would not feel they had been cheated out of a win.
Mordecai Lee, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Mordecai Lee is a professor emeritus in the UW-Milwaukee School of Continuing Education and a former member of the Wisconsin legislature. And you can find more coverage of the state Supreme Court at WUWM.com.
We will take a quick break now and then look at the future of the embattled Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake youth prisons. That's when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
We are back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. There were a few surprises in Governor Evers' two-year budget proposal, but one thing stood out to many, an increase in the Department of Corrections budget. The proposal includes increased funds to replace the embattled Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake youth prisons, which have been the subject of several costly lawsuits in recent years.
Allison Dekanovich has been reporting on the story for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, and she sat down with Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about the future of the youth prisons and how we got to this point.
The decision to close Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake has kind of been a long time coming. It's all in one complex, so it's Lincoln Hills is for boys and Copper Lake is for girls, but it's all kind of the same institution, and there have been open investigations for over 4 years at this point on both the state and the federal level, as well as some pretty significant lawsuits. The state settled an $18.9 million lawsuit with the ACLU regarding the mistreatment of some of the young people up there, and so then last March, the state legislature unanimously passed a bill called Act 185 that will close Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake by 2021. That's as it stands in this bill. That timeline is kind of up in the air, which, well, right now that's what it stands, and there's conversation that that may change, but right now it's set to close by 2021.
So when you mention mistreatment of kids who are living there, what did that include?
Yeah, so, I mean, there have been a lot of various allegations, but what a lot of the investigations have found have kind of been instances of abuse and neglect, specifically excessive use of force in regards to pepper spray and mace and things of that nature, as well as kind of an excessive use of solitary confinement and isolation tactics for young people. There have been some questions on the kinds of searches that are conducted and kind of the frequency of those kinds of searches as a violation of privacy potentially. There's been some concerns about the response time of staff if a young person is in crisis or is calling for help. There have been some concern around that and some incidents that have resulted from that.
So the decision to close these facilities, which, as you mentioned, are kind of one facility in a way,
right?
That happened before Governor Evers came into office. And in his budget, he made some new announcements. He's planning to open two new facilities near Milwaukee, one that would be state-run and the other which would be run by the county. Where would these facilities be located?
Governor Evers did change a lot in his budget. He didn't necessarily change the types of facilities, so that kind of stood in that original bill that passed. The state is going to run these facilities that are called Type 1 facilities, and those are for youth with more serious offenses. There's specifically youth in this program called the Serious Juvenile Offender Program. So that's a specific, like, legal category. And then the other facilities, and this is something new for Wisconsin, that to have these county-run facilities, and those are going to be for young people with less serious offenses but still serious enough that the court finds it necessary to place them in some kind of secure setting. As far as location, the state, that's what Governor Evers just announced, the two locations for these state facilities, so for the more serious offenses, or youth with the most serious offenses, and that will be in Milwaukee, 6600 North Tetonia is the address. It's right by the Safety Academy, the Police Safety Academy. And that site is where the county was also looking to build. So they're not going to share the site. They've decided that they're not going to build both the state and the county in that same site. So now the county is looking for another site to build on. So they're kind of back to the drawing board as far as evaluating different sites. And I think they're expanding their search to look at private property as well as city and county-owned property.
Beyond the site that they chose, there has been some controversy over what was in Governor Evers' budget concerning these youth prisons. What have community members here in Milwaukee been saying about these new proposals?
Yeah, so I think a lot of the concern from community members here in Milwaukee was kind of that of surprise when Governor Evers announced the locations of these facilities. That was kind of news to everyone. Community members, elected officials for those areas, the county, a lot of people were kind of just surprised by that. And so I think with surprise comes a lot of kind of initial reactions, and perhaps there's a lot of room for kind of misinformation or misunderstanding. So I think there was a lot of kind of confusion about what these facilities would be. There's kind of been a range of reactions from community members, everything from, I don't want this facility near my house, I don't want this facility near my kids' school, all the way to, I want there to be more therapy or more different kinds of programs. I want the community to be more involved in these facilities. People have a lot of different thoughts on kinds of the services they want to have available. And I think there are still a lot of questions about what these facilities will be, because leaders have been talking about how they're not going to be a youth prison, they're not going to look like an institution in that way, but there's still a lot that's yet to be determined about, okay, what will they be? I think people are kind of having trouble picturing what these new facilities will actually kind of all include, if that makes sense.
Yeah, some people believe it shouldn't be here at all. Other people believe that it needs to be here, but they have very specific desires for what it should look like.
Yeah, and I guess I feel like people have different beliefs on what kinds of programs will be most helpful for youth who are involved in the justice system. I think some people are frustrated because Governor Evers' budget does significantly increase the amount of that's going to be spent on these facilities. And I think from people that I've talked to, especially different advocates, they're concerned that too much of the money is going into building new buildings, which people say has been kind of shown to be an outdated model. There are youth prisons that are closing all over the country because they're being underutilized. So people are saying, why are we spending all of this money on these buildings when we should be investing in XYZ program? And what those programs are, people have different ideas for things that they would like to see in place.
Has there been any explanation from the Evers administration as to where this money is going to go?
In great detail, not necessarily, but it has been broken down as far as what specific facilities will be getting the money. So, and this isn't confirmed. The state legislature is debating all of this and we'll have to pass this. But Governor Evers is proposing for the Type 1s to increase it from 25 to 115 million. And so that 115 million will be just for those two state-run facilities. The county-run facilities, there's a process, a grant process, where the counties will have to apply for a grant to have one of those county-run facilities in their county. And that originally was allocated for $40 million for all the county facilities or all the counties that wanted to have facilities. And that has been increased to $100 million. And a little bit of context on that number is Milwaukee County has estimated that for the Milwaukee County-run facility, it's going to be a budget of about $39 million. So they were concerned about that original $40 million, that wouldn't be enough for multiple counties to have these facilities. So that's some context for that number. And then the last increase is for Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center, which is the mental health facility, which is also a secure type 1 facility for youth, but it's kind of like a healthcare institution, or it's portrayed as that. I haven't been there, but it was originally allocated $15 million for an expansion, and that has been increased to $59 million. So there's been a significant increase in funding towards Mendota to add more beds there.
Earlier you mentioned Act 185. Can you explain what that act says and does?
Yeah, so that act is the one that calls to close Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake by January 2021, and it says that in its place there will be these state-run facilities for more serious offenders and the county-run facilities for youth with less serious offenses. And it also includes an expansion of Mendota in that original act. That's the general gist of it.
So a lot of what's being funded in the budget proposal.
Yeah, the budget proposal is just increasing the numbers in that bill, essentially. And then there's also the age difference that Governor Evers is proposing to raise the age so that 17-year-olds would go through juvenile court, and then also adjusting the timeline. So he completely suspends the timeline of when Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake would close, and then he extends the timeline for when counties would apply. So right now, as it stands, counties have to apply for their new facilities by the end of March, and then that will go to the Joint Committee on Finance by July. But under Governor Evers' new budget, that deadline would extend to June and then October. And then as soon as all of the youth who are currently in Copper Lake or Lincoln Hills are out of that facility, they're removed into these other alternative places, at that point is when those facilities would finally close. So he kind of removes an official date on that, which has been pretty controversial.
Yeah. The whole Act 185 has been controversial, it seems, from the outset. Why are community advocates hoping to rework parts of that act? What are their objections?
I think Act 185 was definitely passed kind of in a moment of crisis. There was a lot of pressure to pass something. Everyone's agreed, and there has not really been any controversy over the fact that Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake should be closed. That's been a point that everyone has agreed on, and it kind of was passed in a way to expedite that. And then through the implementation process of that, there have been kind of some questions or some bumps in the road or some opportunities for disagreement. And what advocates are really concerned about is that most of the dollars are going to building new buildings. And they'll say that they don't want to widen the net, is a phrase that a lot of advocates have been using, that they don't want to kind of build new facilities with more beds and spend tax dollars on building these facilities that then courts and judges will feel obligated to fill, is kind of the mentality, like if you build it, they will come. So people are concerned that even though people's intentions are saying otherwise, people are expressing concern that it will just be kind of another version of Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, that it's not going to be that different. Now, that's all obviously yet to be determined, but that's where people's concerns lie, that just building another building, building a facility is not necessarily going to solve the root of the problem of why young people are ending up in Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake in the first place. And that spending too money on too big is going to prevent the problem from getting smaller once you invest those dollars.
Well, Allison, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work with us.
Yeah, of course. Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Allison Dekanovich is a reporter with the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. You can find Dekanovich's story about the future of Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake youth prisons at WUWM.com.
We will take another short break and then meet the choreographer for La Morena. It's one of the pieces the Milwaukee Ballet will perform over the next 4 days. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. It is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. The Milwaukee Ballet opens La Morena tonight at the Marcus Center. The show opens with new contemporary dance from international award-winning choreographers Enrico Morelli and George Williamson. But the centerpiece of the evening is the ballet La Morena, created in 1995 by our next guest, Val Canaparoli.
It's a fusion of movement set to a fusion of music. Johann Sebastian Bach melds with African drumming. Traditional ballet melds with traditional African dance. It's been wildly popular in the 24 years since its creation, and it's been staged around the world. That's something Canaparoli says he's thrilled about, but not something he could have ever predicted.
When you do new works, you don't know.
In the ballet world, you're not allowed to have previews and runouts and go out. You expect to be a genius right away, which never happens. But if you're lucky enough for that work to survive the critics, survive that opening, that's when the best time. That's when you start working, when other companies take it. So it's quite extraordinary when you do get a work that does survive that opening night. And La Mirena was exceptional. The opening was amazing. This type of work hasn't really been done that much 24 years ago, using African dance and classical dance combination. So it was quite unusual, and it was the right timing for the ballet at the time, too.
What made you decide to put those two very different dance disciplines together in the first place?
Well, it premiered San Francisco Ballet, 1995, and I was asked to work for their prima ballerina at the time, Evelyn Cisneros, and she's a very exotic, strong woman, really just an amazing dancer. And I couldn't find the music, and I wanted to find something that matched her strength and power and being exotic like she is on stage. And I couldn't find it, and I was emailing a friend of mine in Paris, and she said, well, I've got the right music. And she said, I got this CD, a wedding gift, and it's called La Mirena. And she said, it's this fusion of Bach and African music. And she said, it's perfect. And I'll FedEx it to you right away. I got it, and it was perfect. And it got it just in time because it was 2 days before I was supposed to start rehearsal, which is daunting right there. So
you hadn't actually created the ballet yet?
No. And so the music was the inspiration. I was just blown away by it. It's not altering the African. It's not altering the Bach. It is really putting them together and apart. And recognizing the rhythms are similar, it's just a celebration. It was so joyful. It was so wonderful. I went, I'm in love with this music. And right away, bam, that was
You
it.
Knew what you wanted to do with it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And right away, which I do a lot of, and a lot of, at that point, and not so much still, I collaborate with, if I do something with ballroom, I bring in ballroom dancers, or with literature, I bring in dramaturgs, I bring in people. In this case, San Francisco is so rich and diverse with ethnic dance groups. And a company called Diamna Kuro in the East Bay, and Zachary Sao Diouf and his wife Naomi, I didn't know them, but I was told about them. And I called them right away. I said, would you mind collaborating with me? I don't know what we're going to do. How are we going to fuse this, the African and the classical dance? And we just went in the studio together, the dancers, and just sort of figured it out. I learned a lot about African dance. I still learn from them 24 years later. And it's just been developed since. But it was really developed in the studio and really blindly, because we really didn't know how we were going to deal with this. Because you have classical ballet, Women on Point, which makes it difficult because African dance is down in the ground.
I was going to say, yes. That's my understanding, is it's much more rooted.
It's very rooted into earth and sky and elements and the environment and everything. And even the eyes are choreographed. And dance, classical ballet is up in the air. And we're doing both. It is such a difficult ballet for the dancers to grasp. But once they do, for the first 10 years when companies would do it, Zach and Naomi would come to each company with us, with me and my assistant, Mikey Mignosa, and we would have them teach African dance to the company. After they had their classical dance, they'd do a 45, half hour to 45 minutes of African dance. And we, just to get them, because it's really rooted in actual African dance, and to have them understand it from the source is so important. And in Milwaukee, this year we've had two African dance consultants, Roxy Kess and Yaya Kambaya, to work with the dancers, and they still are. They're coming in, and every once in a while, just keep that authenticity. But this work can only be done by a classical dance company because it is on point, and it is classical. It's not a modern dance. It really has to have strong, strong classical technique, and that's the challenge of getting those strong classical dancers to be more grounded. And it's always interesting, and it's usually met with a lot of energy. The dancers love it, and just to try something different.
Something new.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Do you find in the 24 years since you first set this that dancers are a little more, maybe not open is not the word I'm looking for, but are a little more aware of other dance forms than they might have been in 1995? There seems to be a lot more cross-pollination.
Right. It's hard for me to say because my entire career was in San Francisco. And San Francisco is so diverse. And you see that all the time. Our ethnic dance festival is gigantic. And so many dance companies in San Francisco. So we've always been exposed to it. And San Francisco Ballet has always brought in such eclectic and different choreographers from all walks of life. So I don't see the difference. I see in the 24 years, I've seen technique stronger, classical. You know, I've seen that. So I don't really know how to answer that, to be honest.
Yeah, it's just interesting because it seems like fusion has been a watchword for the last decade or so, where
right.
a lot of
right.
disciplines are
right.
are borrowing and talking to other ones that they may not have 30
right,
years
right.
ago.
And that's what was so unusual 24 years ago. I imagine the artistic director of San Francisco Ballet looking at me like, are you crazy? Because they would bring in, Zach and Naomi, they would bring in their entire family of children. And they'd be coming in and helping the dancers and little tiny children. It's just the culturally, I mean, if you go to their dance company, it is filled with family and filled with even the studios. It's amazing. It's just, I loved it. So it was just different. And it was so at that point, like, what are you doing? And I just blindly went forward. I said, I don't care. I'm going to try this. And it still resonates today, which is, I keep looking at it going, well, should you change things? I go, no, because dance has evolved. It's different, you know. Tastes are different. But it just seems to work, even no matter what continent it's done on. It's been done in South Africa.
Yeah.
It's been done in Asia. It's been done in Moscow. It's been done a lot of places. So it's always resonates. You always have your detractors, your purists, that you can't do that, either musically or dance-wise. You should not be mixing cultures. And my thing is, dance is universal. Dance unites people. That's how you learn each other's culture, through dance. Why not? You know. So, but I do get some, you know.
Pushback,
and I ignore it. It's what it is.
Well, you have a musical background
before
you went into dance, and so you know, musics have been borrowing from each other.
Oh,
Western music
absolutely.
Has taken in folk
absolutely.
Traditions from all kinds of places.
Well, a lot of there was this album I don't remember the name, but it was all with the modern contemporary composers of note now, and they would match it with an African counterpart. It was exactly, and some of these composers did study in Africa. So yes, they have borrowed. They borrowed the rhythms. There is part of that. Lumbarina was dedicated to Albert Schweitzer, who had a missionary in Gabon, and he was a Bach enthusiast and scholar. So that combination right there was, that's why it was called, but it's Lumbarina with an E at the end. So that connection right there. And that's where he did the combination. He would play Bach. He would hear the African. It was like it was this combination that it was great when you hear it.
Have you seen the Milwaukee Ballet yet in rehearsal?
Yes.
Yeah.
I got here Monday. So
and so what do you think so far?
We're still working on it. It's difficult.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing really well. And they're amazing dancers and enthusiastic and what more could you want?
Right. Oh, I think it's going to be fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I, again, love the idea of that fusion, of that melding of different cultural expressions and tropes and mm-hmm. all of those things. Because, as you say, art is universal.
Absolutely.
And it's, I think it's what makes us human.
Mm-hmm.
It's that desire to express
right.
and to be joyful in public and to be sad and to bring all of mm-hmm. those human emotions, you know, together in your career. And I was looking at the number of dances mm-hmm. that you have, you know, ballets that you've created.
Mm-hmm. And I'm only 19.
I
no,
know.
No, is it crazy?
You're just a child prodigy. It's fantastic. Just think of what you'll do, when you're 30.
Exactly.
If you could no longer, if you woke up tomorrow and said, okay, my career's over, I'm done, is this one of the pieces that you would basically say, I'm so proud to have done this?
Well, it's one of them. If be careful, I have one piece that defines you. I mean, my work is so diverse. It's all over the map. I mean,
I noticed that from the list.
What I'm proud of is the feedback I get from a lot of people is, your work is so different all the time. I can tell maybe stylistically, but it's just different. You can do three of my works in one evening, and they would all be different. subject matter, music approach and design and everything. And I love that. So it's hard to say if that's the one. It's one that gets performed the most. I know that. But I have so many that maybe are not performed the most that I'm way more proud of. But again, I got to be proud of a work that is performed so much. I mean, like I said, if you're lucky enough for a ballet to survive and have legs and keep going other places. And even now I get correspondence like, can we have this ballet? And I go, where did you even find out about that ballet? It was like 30 years ago. You know, but I love that. And I go, well, I would love to do it, but you have to allow me to rework some of it. I always say choreographers are always working their ballets as it goes on. I mean, Balanchine worked on his masterpieces up until his death. I mean, it's just part of the process.
Is that depending on the dancers that you're working with that makes you see things slightly differently?
Well, it's also how you see things differently. I have a full-length Lady of the Camellias that is 25 years old now that makes the rounds, is equally performed as much as La Morena. And since the opening 25 years ago, I've learned so much on it's probably 45, almost hour have been cut out of it. You edit yourself. You go, wow, I've said that already, or that music didn't work. I need to change that. You just learn. You know, you mature. You sit back and you look at it. And even today, it was just this ballet's just performed in Kansas City Ballet, Lady of the Camellias, and I even changed things. I went, wow, why didn't I see that even like 3 years ago? But it's just part of the process.
And, you know, one of the great things about dance is people, I mean, it's a downside in that people say it's ephemeral, you know, mm-hmm. And then until very recently where we had the ability to capture it on video, it was there and then it wasn't.
Right,
you know, if
right.
you didn't see it, you didn't see it.
Right.
But as an artist, what you get to do, that very thing allows you to go back and revise and rethink and, you know, where a novelist
absolutely
can't really do that. It's
absolutely.
Printed.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, they don't get to go back.
But you have like a lot of the classic full lengths now where they're like 4 hours long, even the opera. You go, people can't sit that long anymore. I mean, we didn't have TV back then, so they could come in. And you've got to edit those now. It's just that people are different now. And I always advise even younger choreographers that are going to do their full lengths. I go, two acts, you know. Two acts is the way to go now, not three, not four. But it's just people are different.
Tell your story in the two acts.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And it's totally possible, you know. But like I said, lifestyles have changed immensely.
Right. So. Well, and as you say, dance has changed too.
Yes, I mean, absolutely.
And the way we approach going to see live performance has changed. And mm-hmm. all of those things are different. Is there anything you're thinking about now that might come in the future? Or is that stuff you don't talk about
ahead of time? A lot of it's legal. I can't.
Oh,
but
okay.
There's one huge one I can say will be done in Finland. A giant project I'm really proud of. And, you know, just a lot of revivals, a lot of new works coming up. I'm really lucky. I book like 2 to 3 years in advance. And
terrific.
That's the way to go. And I'm still pinching myself and going, how did that happen?
I am so lucky.
I'm lucky.
Well, we are so lucky to have you in town.
Great, thank you.
To have La Morena about to be on the stage. And I hope you will come back the next time you're in town with us and let's talk more about dance.
Yeah, I want to be here for the new building that it opens. So.
I think you need to set a new dance in the new building.
I think so, too.
There you go. You heard it on the radio.
Thank you.
Val, it has been such a pleasure.
Great.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Choreographer Val Canaparoli's ballet, La Morena, is part of an evening of dances presented by Milwaukee Ballet. The performances will take place at Eline Hall starting tonight and running through the weekend. You'll find out more at WUWM.com.
We will take one last break and then chat with Wisconsin novelist Nick Butler, whose new book tackles some major questions about the nature of faith and religion and also paints a positive picture of small-town Wisconsin life. You are listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
This is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Back in 2008, the death of a Wisconsin girl made headlines here and around the country when it was revealed that her family had foregone medical treatment for diabetes in favor of faith healing. That story and the questions it raised provide some of the backdrop for the latest novel by writer Nicholas Butler. Little Faith is set in a small fictional town in western Wisconsin, not too far from Butler's real home in Eau Claire.
It is told through the experiences of 65-year-old Lyle Hovde, who is generally content with his life and his role as a retiree, grandfather, and occasional apple harvester. The book plays out over the seasons of a year and leads Lyle and readers to ask some deep but fundamental questions about the nature of faith and religion. Nicholas Butler joins us in the studio now to answer some fundamental questions about the new novel. Welcome back to the show.
Nice to see you again. I'm happy to be back.
It's great to see you again, and congratulations on the new book.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm really excited about it. I feel pretty lucky to live the life that I live and to publish these books, and I'm pretty proud of this one. I think it does what I wanted it to do. So.
Well, let's start with that. What were you hoping it would do?
Well, I had kind of two ideas. One was to sort of, you know, I had been kind of influenced a little bit by this sort of true crime case that happened back in 2008 where a young girl died of complications of diabetes because her parents were praying for her rather than seeking medical treatment. So that was one thing that I researched prayer healing in America a whole lot. But I began thinking that that would be a really dark book if that's what the only sort of narrative thrust was. So I started thinking that a way to kind of camouflage that or toggle that would be to write a story about a grandpa and his grandson and that kind of amazingly sweet, special relationship between the very old and the very young, and trying to braid those two stories together. So,
yeah, well, and I was hoping to kind of get into who Lyle is pretty early, because it's really through his experiences that we watch this story unfold. Lyle seems to be about the most decent person you could imagine, maybe the guy we all sort of hope we might be when we're 65.
Yeah, well, so Lyle is not based on my father-in-law, Jim, but he's certainly inspired by my father-in-law. And I'd known Jim, I should also say, I've known Jim since I was about 12 years old. But I think after I got married, I realized that because he has juvenile diabetes, his family had always sort of looked at his lifespan as, you know, like when he was a younger man, they told him he might not live past 50. So I started to write. I wrote a short story called Apples, which is in my short story collection, and it's about a character named Lyle. And basically, I wanted to kind of preserve the memory of who this guy was and what he means to his family and to his community. And that character had always kind of hung around. And then I just decided, like, well, I can riff off my own work. That's fine. I'm not stealing from anyone. So I wanted to write this novel that was about him and kind of celebrating his spirit. And you know, I think a lot of us, after we pass away, I wonder whether anyone's going to remember us. But one way to preserve a person's memory or spirit is in a book and in fiction. So that was certainly one of the goals here, too.
Well, and I wonder, and he's obviously not here to speak for himself, but someone who deals with such a serious illness for presumably such a long time has to have a certain outlook on life. It's the kind of thing that can either make one extremely bitter for their whole life or extremely grateful and giving, and it sounds like he's the latter.
Yeah, he's, you know, you said like that Lyle is an almost unbelievably good guy. And when you meet my father-in-law, Jim, he's like that, too. He's just incredibly helpful and kind. And the longer that I live and the longer that I live near him, the more people that I meet whom he has influenced positively. You know, he just like he'll volunteer to go fix somebody's kitchen sink or their dishwasher or something like that. And he never wants anything in return. And he's not doing it for selfish reasons. He's just that kind of person. And, you know, frankly, I don't know that we read a lot of fiction where there's characters like that, but that doesn't mean that they don't exist in the real world.
I mean, did you worry about making him too decent?
No. No, because he, you know, one way that we see who he is as a full human being and in an honest way is the fact that he really struggles with his faith, that he's in some ways angry with God.
Well, right. And so Lyle in the book dealt from a long time ago with the loss of an infant.
Yeah.
How would you describe Lyle's approach to spirituality by the time he was 65?
Yeah. Well, I think I almost want to have like a glossary of terms because, you know, there's like spirituality and religiosity. There's all these sort of different belief terms. But I think Lyle believes in something beyond the plane of normal human existence. But he can't quite go into believing that there's like a God in the clouds. And he can't quite believe in the Bible. He can't quite believe in church. So I think, you know, and not to sound like New Agey or anything like that, but he sees beauty in the natural world. He sees beauty in the orchard that he works in and the seasons and in his grandson. But he really is jaded on organized religion, if that makes sense.
I wonder if, would you be willing to read maybe a little bit of the start to chapter 5, which is kind of where we start to understand really who Lyle is and where he's coming from when it comes to faith or spirituality or religiosity or God.
Sure.
And yeah, I don't know, maybe read till it seems natural to stop reading.
Okay. Although Lyle had stopped believing, he never really stopped attending church. Indeed, he often suspected he was not alone in this, that many millions of Christians, Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, Taoists, and Mormons all around the world attended their churches, temples, and mosques as much out of routine or obligation as out of any real fervor or belief. Or perhaps to model a new dress or hat, a new pair of shoes, or a sharp suit. Guilt, he supposed, must also have played a role, for certainly not every butt in a pew was doing the Lord's work 24/7. Some might secretly be cheating on their taxes, sleeping with the neighbor's wife or husband, playing the casino slot machines or roulette tables with the children's college fund, or who knew what other litany of shortcomings from the trivial to the criminal. For others, it might be boredom or loneliness. But for Lyle, so much depended on his childhood friend, Pastor Charlie, and that lovely old country church in which he had spent so many Sundays as a child, shuffled into that hard-backed pew by his now long-departed parents.
Nicholas Butler reading from A Little Faith. You mentioned the kind of true crime story that undergirds at least part of this tale. Mm-hmm. Was that the catalyst that got you thinking about faith, God, religion, whatever we want to call it, or is there something there? Were you thinking about it in other ways already?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think I've been thinking a lot about it personally. When my wife and I moved back to Eau Claire, We returned to our childhood Lutheran church, the church we both grew up in, matriculated through, you know, communion and confirmation classes and all that good stuff. And we kind of wanted to give our children that same sort of infrastructure, spiritual infrastructure that we grew up with. The trouble is that I don't really believe in God. So here I am, you know, not every Sunday. I'm not going to claim to have perfect church attendance because I don't really care. But I'm sitting in my church just thinking, like, what am I doing here? And what am I getting out of this? And trying to believe in something, you know, I think allowing myself to be open to some supernatural being finding me. But nothing ever takes.
And there's kind of one point where I think it's – I forget who Lyle's talking with, maybe to Hoot, his old friend, or it might have been to Pastor Charlie. But he's basically saying, you know, as long as everybody's kind of good to each other and does right by each other and, you know, whether we call it religion or not, it seems to be the way you live your life.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think I agree with that, though – I think for me, good writing is not judgmental, right? You're trying to not be judgmental about your characters that you create. You're hopefully looking to understand more about the way that people in the real world make their decisions and live their lives, and also how your fictional characters do that. And I mean, I've met people in my life that really, really believed, and I'm not trying to mock anyone who believes at all. I'm very curious about that. And I've met people whose lives were changed for the better by believing or being reborn or something like that. So, you know, when I handed this book into my agent, he really loved it. And he's a tough critic, but he said, man, nobody's really writing this book right now. And I didn't even think about that because I went to the Iowa Writers Workshop and Marilyn Robinson was a teacher there and Jim McPherson, people who, you know, write a lot about spirituality. But I just don't think it's very sort of in vogue right now. It's a little bit taboo. It's, you know, I think a lot of people think maybe it's even old-fashioned, but to me, it's one of the universal questions about us as human beings? What happens to us after we die? Is there a soul that goes somewhere else? And so I was really interested in it.
There's really, and you know, I never want to give too much away, but there's a point at which Lyle is called on to help pray for somebody, and he can't do it. And it's a really heartbreaking scene because I think on its face it's heartbreaking, but you can see how much that inability is kind of tearing him up inside.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, Lyle is 25 years older than I am, I guess, or 26 years older than I am, but we obviously share some similarities. I wouldn't be able to write him if there wasn't part of me there. And I mean, those Sundays when I'm sitting in church and everybody else is praying, my eyes have always been open, and I just have a really difficult time sort of letting go. And it is hard, you know. I mean, when you're in a community like that of people who really fervently believe, and it seems to give them some sort of grace or solace, and you don't really feel that. I don't know. It's odd.
Are your fellow parishioners aware of the book you've written?
I don't know. I don't know. I just try to, you know. I think the quick answer to that is I don't know. You know, I choose to live in my hometown because nobody treats me differently. So I just sort of move along, not thinking about stuff.
You talk about not being judgmental in writing, and there's a character in this book. He's a sort of a charismatic preacher who moves into Eau Claire, I think, or La Crosse.
Right.
I can't remember.
Yeah.
And it would be really easy to caricature him, but you seem to go to great lengths to give him some, you know, deep down. Redeeming characteristics, redeeming probably being the wrong choice of words here.
Yeah, well, I mean, if a book's going to have a character that could sort of be identified as a villain, I think the work of a writer is to try and figure out how that person came to be a villain. And, you know, in preparation for this book, I read a lot about faith healing and prayer healing, and I also just listened to some pretty fringe pastors, like on YouTube, and also listening to my AM radio dial every day. And when I'm driving across rural Wisconsin, I'd listen to stuff. And I'm not picking on anyone. I'm not being judgmental. Part of it was trying to get inside to understand, okay, well, you know, what makes up this opinion, this group of beliefs? And I'm hopeful that people, atheists, agnostics, Buddhists, Jews, Christians, read this book. So I'd be kind of foolish to be making fun of anyone or to be, you know, making clear villains.
This is a strange way to ask this question. Not so long ago, I'm gonna name drop another writer here, and that's Leif Enger, who wrote this pretty wonderful book called Virgil Wander. And I was struck by two reviews of it that I read. Mm-hmm. One was by Ron Charles in the Washington Post, mm-hmm. and the other was by you in the New York Times.
Yeah.
And reading it, I got the sense that there are some people who get characters from small towns in the Midwest, mm-hmm. and there are some people who do not, and those people are often on the coasts. Mm-hmm. So I guess in an extremely roundabout way, the people who inhabit Little Faith are not so different than the people who inhabit Virgil Wander.
Yeah.
You know, Lyle and Peg, but also Charlie and Hoot and Shiloh and others. Mm-hmm. Do you think these are familiar people? Are you in some strange way an ambassador to what real people are like for, you know, those of us in flyover country to people on the coasts?
Yeah.
Wow, that was a long question.
Geez, I don't know. I mean, I'd like to think that this book could easily be set in, I don't know, upstate New York, rural Virginia, a lot of different places, Northern California, the Wyoming and Colorado that I just traveled through. There's a lot of places where I know these characters exist. What you asked is a tough question. And, you know, I really enjoyed a lot of Leif Enger's book. It was a difficult book to review because it was a comedy and it was filled with magical realism. And I tried as hard as I could in that. I loved it let me just say that. It was filled with clearly a lot of the author's passions. And I think when you're writing fiction, you should be rewarded for that. But one thing I was struck by that Washington Post review is that it didn't seem like the reviewer took any time to try and understand what the writer was doing. It was like it was kind of a lazy review. And in some ways, it was a little bit mean-spirited. And that's what kind of struck me about it. That was a book full of really kind characters, and some of them were magical. They were different. They were stepping out of like a mist almost, you know, and flying kites in storms. It wasn't really meant to be like a perfect representation of northern Minnesota, I don't think. And I tried with this book to modulate light and dark. There's a lot of happy stuff here. There's a lot of stuff that I think is the upside of living in a beautiful place without a lot of people. But there's a dark side, too, and that's that these small towns are dying and that sometimes the people that live in those small towns are susceptible to, this evangelist.
So I was reading back through an interview you gave leading up to the Chippewa Valley Book Festival last fall. And you gave a shout out to your fifth grade teacher.
Yeah.
Who you said was one of the most influential people in your life. And the interviewer did not ask the obvious follow up question. And I don't know whether it was just because it was an email interview or something. But I'm going to do that a few months later. What was so influential about your fifth grade teacher?
Yeah, Doug Smith. Shout out to Doug Smith. And I know you've got some listeners who are also his student. So he was kind of an older gentleman when I had him as a teacher. He was probably grandfatherly age. He'd played semi-professional baseball with like Warren Spahn and Hank Aaron. And when I think about the expectations for 21st century school children like my kids versus what we experienced in his classroom, it's totally different. And his classroom was, and I'm not saying anything mean about my kids' teachers because I love them, but his teaching style was so different. He just read to us for long periods in the day, classics like, I think Ivanhoe was one, which is, you know, that's like college level reading. And one of our projects during that year, fifth grade year I was with him, was we had to write a fictional account of the westward migration across America. We had all year to work on it, to research it, and most kids, I think, ended up around 25 to 40 pages, and mine ended up being 120 pages.
In fifth grade.
Yeah, in the fifth grade. Still one of the longer things I've written, by the way. And I think it's really amazing and sort of magical. If you give kids books and you give them stories and you give them time to write what they'll do, and I think it's so hard to measure, right? We live in a society where increasingly we're pushing kids to have sort of practical jobs. So I don't have a practical job at all, you know, and I think I contribute a fair amount to my community and to our state, I'd like to think, too, even. And I couldn't do that if I had a practical job. That's just not who I am, you know, and he was the one who sort of filled me with some early confidence.
Well, I think we can all be grateful to Doug Smith.
Doug Smith, yeah, no doubt.
Everybody, shout out to Doug Smith. And we're grateful to you, Nick Butler. Thank you so much for coming to see us again.
Yeah, thanks, Mitch.
Wisconsin writer Nick Butler's latest novel is called Little Faith. It came out in February, and we spoke with him then. And it wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tighe. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll listen again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh Air is next, so stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.